This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're all testing out what it feels like to say President Bill Clinton. We asked James Fallows to share some of his thoughts about our president-elect. Fallows is the Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. He's completing a book about the rise of Asian economies. And he was part of the previous Democratic administration. He was President Carter's chief speechwriter. Fallows spoke with us earlier today from his home in Washington, D.C. I asked him about his hopes for the Clinton administration and his reservations about it. Let's start with his hopes.
My main hope for what Bill Clinton might do as president rests on the fact that I think what he cares about most is what, in my view, most needs doing in this country, which is to pay some attention to both the economic fundamentals of how we earn our way and kind of the social comity, the sense of everybody being part of one family. I think Ross Perot, to his credit, was talking about both those things, too. George Bush, I think the battles of his generation were different battles than those, but I think these are the battles of Bill Clinton's generation, and I think he cares about them. And so the best analogy and the most hopeful analogy I might use is that of Franklin Roosevelt when he came in early 1933. Certainly the situation is different in that it is not the Great Depression and the world is not heading off the cliff, but there is this similarity, I think. You could argue that Bill Clinton does not know now exactly what he wants to do about the economy, about manufacturing competitiveness, about the welfare system, about health care, about whatever, but he knows he wants to do something. And similarly, Franklin Roosevelt didn't know what he wanted to do about the Depression, but he knew that he had to do something. And so there was a lot of experimentation, some blind alleys, but in the end, they did do something. And I think Clinton will have, for better and worse, the same impulse to do something, and that, on balance, I think would be good for the country.
Your reservations?
Reservation, I guess, has to do with parts of his nature and part of the Democratic Party's nature. On the personal front, Clinton's very strength could have as its other side his weakness. He seems to be a man of enormous appetites and ambitions and energies. He's brought himself from Hope, Arkansas to the presidency at the age of 46, and he has willed his way through terrible troubles. And it is very rare to find that kind of personality as a completely positive package. Often there are some surprising little time bombs buried within it. I don't know what they might be. It may be that he's been so tried in the last year of campaigning that all the bad parts have been boiled out, but we'll see. And I should say also that to Clinton's credit, as a matter of temperament, both Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter, as Southerners, seem to be constantly tormented by the idea that the pointy heads were looking down at them, that the Ivy Leaguers were sort of sneering at them. Clinton seems to have none of that impulse at all, even when George Bush was ridiculing him time and again for his tiny state background. The other reservation has to do with the Democratic Party and how it will respond to the world we're in right now. Clinton, even in his exultation at this moment, may feel a little bit sober to realize that now he has to actually do something about the economy. Now he has to actually do something about the federal budget deficit. And if there were easy ways to do that, somebody would have done them by now. And so the question is whether it's possible for him to kind of rouse people to the efforts that are needed to deal with these problems.
Clinton has promised to include Republicans who are willing to roll up their sleeves and work for change. How unconventional a promise is that?
John Kennedy did the same thing when he came in, and it's just smart politics. There is a natural tendency to want to rub salt in all of your opponent's new wounds and just kind of cackle at their agony. This is a temptation I strongly understand and felt very overwhelmingly when James Baker came on the screen last night. But it was interesting that as soon as George Bush lost this campaign, the good Bush came back, and he was talking about doing what's right for the nation, and Clinton very shrewdly responded in exactly the same tone, because he has everything to gain by trying to bring more people into his tent. Again, the person who seems most similar to him, in my mind, in our recent political memory, is Lyndon Johnson, the sense of wanting, where his basic impulse is to get people into the tent, wanting people to be in his family, wanting people to be around him. In Johnson, there seemed to be a kind of edge of craziness or darkness that went with that we haven't yet seen in Clinton, but that's the impulse that seems most similar to me.
What do you think is happening in the Republican Party about now?
Well, what's been happening among my Republican friends for the last two or three weeks is basically people looking for work, and looking for work, and yet even more actively than that, deflecting blame, concocting all these theories about, gee, if only they'd done this or that. I have some firsthand experience here. All of us who were associated with the Carter administration became very proficient at sort of explaining why it all could have been saved if only they had listened to us. If only they listened to the right advisors, then things would not have gone off the cliff. And that's, I think, the main activity today.
Right. As either Clinton or Gore pointed out in their speeches last night, and I wrote this down and neglected to take note of which said it, and now I don't remember, but one of them said that for the first time in the White House, there's a generation of leaders born after World War II. As someone who is part of the same generation that Clinton and Gore are, what do you think the significance of that is?
Well, it's horrifying and yet true to realize that we already were halfway there in the Bush-Quayle administration. Quayle was also, I think he's about the same age as, he's between Clinton's and Gore's age. But having the whole ticket that way has, I think, it has one sort of chastening effect to those of us who are their contemporaries. You think, well, gee, you know, if I'd been living my life correctly, I could have
<That's right. laughs>
I could have made something of myself, too. And you do remember these people from your youth. And Al Gore was roughly a contemporary of mine in college. And so you think, gee, somebody I knew is actually running things. How safe can we be? But on the high road, I think there are two things they can bring. One is they simply are, they have more oomph and more energy than someone their father's generation does. I never approved of these endless pictures of Clinton jogging. I don't think that's an aesthetically pleasing sight. But I think the implied message there was that here is somebody with pep. Here's somebody who thinks that his life challenges are still ahead. Also, these are people who don't think that their main life's work is either beating the Germans and Japanese in World War II or beating the Russians after World War II, those being the two main challenges of George Bush's lifetime. And so they've come of age where kind of the plot line of their generation is one of decline from some golden past. And their challenge as adults is to find ways to reverse the decline, real or perceived. And so I think that does attune them to what needs doing now. But I may just be saying that because I'm their age.
I thought this campaign, in a way, played a final reprise of old generation gap themes like the draft, being against the war in Vietnam, did you smoke marijuana, what does that mean? In a way, I think this really might be the final reprise of that in a political campaign.
It's interesting to me that there are basically three of those leftover generational cleavages, and I think they're resolved and unresolved in different ways. One of them is the did you smoke pot cleavage, and basically that seems to have no mileage to it at all anymore. I don't think anyone really cares about that, and Clinton's only mistake was not preemptively disclosing this a couple of years ago, as Gore and many others did. A second one, which probably will be with us in the longest term of all, is that about the changing role of women. And this is basically why Hillary Clinton had to be put in the closet during the last couple of months of the campaign, because this is sort of an ongoing cultural issue to resolve, both, you know, within any given generation and between generations. The one that seems most poisonous, especially among men of the Vietnam generation and between those men and their fathers, is, of course, what did you do in the war? And it seems to me that there is at least the potential for this election helping resolve that. The main grievance against Clinton is not so much that he didn't fight for his country, but that he seems so uncomfortable with the whole issue and wasn't able, so to speak, to come clean about it. I would think that during the campaign, he had every interest to kind of say as little as possible about the issue, because every time he brought it up, he was just sort of drawing attention to it. I would hope that sometime as president, he would reflect on this in a more expansive way and maybe help lay it to rest. But the very fact that he won, I think, should help lay this somewhat to rest, too.
What did you think of the way Bush handled the draft and the way Clinton tried to explain his own decisions?
I think the best interpretation of the trouble Clinton had is one that Charlie Peters, a friend of mine who's the editor of the Washington Monthly, wrote in his magazine a couple of months ago. And he said that basically what's going on here is that Clinton must not have forgiven himself for what he did in the war years. What Charlie meant by forgiving himself is that there was a certain picture that most people of my generation had in our minds growing up in the 50s and early 60s. Most of our fathers had been in World War II or in the Korean War. In the late 50s and early 60s, basically all men went into the military service. There was what was in effect a nearly universal draft. John Kennedy had been a wartime hero. And so there was the idea that this was a sort of manly thing to do. It was the natural stage in life's progression to be in uniform for your country. There was a kind of cognitive dissonance in the late 1960s where if you ended up thinking that you were against the Vietnam War and for some combination of ignoble and worthy motives you didn't want to go, you then had to sort of feel how you felt about yourself. The main reaction for people from that age was to try not to think about it later on, and because they felt uncomfortable with it. It didn't fit the view they had of what they wanted to be as men, how they wanted to live their lives, and so they tried to kind of cram the whole issue to one side. There are things that people should hold themselves accountable for, that they didn't put themselves more on the line, didn't formally refuse induction, et cetera, et cetera. But the point Charlie Peters was making is that Clinton hadn't really reckoned about what things he felt proud of in opposing the war in Vietnam, what things he felt uncomfortable about or even ashamed about, that he hadn't gone through this normal ritual of masculinity. And for that reason, he just tried to sort of shunt off the issue when it first came up, and then got into this terrible box of having to kind of salami slice his explanations and go through this endless ROTC fact-checking and people saying this, people saying that. The best thing that the draft issue brought out was the voice of many, many veterans, such as the two Senators Kerry in the Senate, saying, look, we paid a price in Vietnam, a physical price, and we don't think it is worthy to try to divide the nation again on this issue. We don't hold this against Bill Clinton, et cetera, et cetera. That was the best thing it brought out, and it would be nice if at some point, with the election behind him, Clinton could again reflect on what he is proud of and what he is ashamed of in those years. Sensibly, he avoided doing that during the campaign, but he now has the luxury and, I would say, the obligation to go into it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Fallows. He's the Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine, and he's currently writing a book on the rise of Asian economies. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Fallows, Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. You interviewed Bill Clinton for a piece that was written for The Atlantic. What were your personal impressions of him?
First, at the just kind of gossip magazine level, he is both bigger and less athletic-seeming than you would think. When you see him and Gore together in photos, it looks like they're a kind of matched set, these two big, sort of burly people. I think they're very different physical types. Gore looks like an athlete who has gone a little bit to seed, but is still basically an athlete. Clinton, if you will forgive me, looks kind of like a fat boy, a guy who is just sort of big, and I think his lifetime battle is going to be with physical shape. I may have the sort of the ectomorph's worldview in saying this, but that's one the main physical impression. He's just bigger than you expect. He fills up the room. That's connected to a trait of personality. My strongest feeling in meeting him is that this was a person who was just born as a politician. Maybe it was genetic, maybe it was the particular way he was raised, but he has the natural gift of making you feel important, making you feel listened to, making you want to like him. People, since there's such a low regard for politicians in general, people are surprised to find when they meet them they're generally so charming. That's not a surprise. That's why people go into politics, because they are charming. He also is, as I think people have seen on TV, he is very smart in a kind of raw processing information way. That you ask him a question and he will give you a well-formed answer with lots of facts. There's one other detail that comes out, I think, when you meet him that doesn't come through as much on TV, which is there is a kind of wryness to him, a kind of edge that doesn't really come across. When he's on the camera, he generally seems to be worthy and earnest and sincere and not really to have that much of a self-mocking approach. when I got the feeling when we were talking to him for this interview that he was kind of aware of putting on a certain show, that he had a little bit of self-mockery, that he knew there was a kind of game of politics, which he loved and which he's very good at, but that once we put down our pencils and turned off the tape recorders, he was talking a little more casually than he had been before. He's making little jokes, little wisecracks. And there hasn't been that much of him that's come across on TV yet.
Mm-hmm. In the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic, that you co-wrote for The Atlantic, you described him as being a mix of the A student and the Pole, the politician. Can you go into that mix a little bit?
What I was trying to say there is that I think there are two innate parts of his characteristic. One is that he, more than most people who know a lot about policy, he really loves politics. This is a guy from the mold of Lyndon Johnson, of Mayor Daley, of other machine politicians who are, Mayor Curley, other people who really like the doing of politics, meeting people, addressing crowds, putting deals together. And so I have the feeling that is one of his primal passions, of getting the job done and dealing with the mechanics. At the same time, he is smart enough and has enough kind of smart friends and has spent enough time in worthy academic institutions that he prides himself on being, as he puts it, a policy wonk. He likes to have those 6-point answers. He likes to have the 90-point programs and is proud of that, too. I think probably his greater gift is the Paul-type gift, but he's probably prouder of the policy wonk-type gift. And many times these two things come into sync with each other, and ideally they'd be completely in sync, as with Franklin Roosevelt. There are times, however, when they conflict. For example, Clinton in his A student manifestation knows that there should be a gasoline tax, and he knows there should be some control of Social Security. But the politician part of him knows that those are losing issues. And so he attacked Paul Tsongas, who was the kind of the pure A student, on both those issues. And it will be interesting to see which of those segments of him wins out.
And he's going to have advisors representing both sides of him on that, and they'll be at odds with each other.
Well, it'll be very interesting to think, say, of James Carville and Robert Reich in the same room.
What did you find interesting about that?
Well, that Carville is who I've never met, is portrayed as kind of this Louisiana swamp fox who knows how to just use the dagger to eviscerate any of his foes politically, whereas Reich, who I'm using as a shorthand for Clinton's policy advisors, has all the numbers and all the theories, and they seem to inhabit separate universes, except that they're both very close to Bill Clinton. And so he can combine them in his person, and it'll be interesting to see whether they can be combined in the long run in his administration.
Looking back on Clinton's political record, do you see him as a, quote, waffler, or as somebody who sees the nuances within things and so can say, listen, on the one hand, on the other hand?
I think the waffling charge was always inaccurate. He's been, rather than a waffler, he's been a deal maker and conciliator, that where he's after after his first term in Arkansas, he came back and, much like Michael Dukakis after his defeat, had a more nuanced and cautious version of what he wanted to do. I think he hasn't waffled on his basic goals at all in the almost 20 years he's been in public life. So the good side of that trait is that he is more likely to get things done with the Congress than, say, Jimmy Carter was with his purist approach. The bad side may be excessive willingness to compromise. The campaign suggests more good than bad, because he was able to move towards a direction keeping everybody in one team, and he didn't give away too much. But we'll see whether the good or bad side of a compromising nature wins out.
You worked for the previous Democratic administration. Now that there's a new Democratic administration headed toward Washington, even though you're a journalist now, does part of you wish that you were back in politics again? Or are you glad to be outside looking in?
Part of me, yes, does. And the reason that I say that is that my theory is that journalists have and should exercise one free pass into government. I think it's good for journalists to have worked in government once, just because you see things differently. For example, you don't believe in conspiracy theories if you worked in the government. You realize they can't be pulled off, and most things happen by accident rather than design. But I think you can't do it repeatedly and still be a journalist, so I don't have any interest in doing that again. But when there is a new beginning like this, I think anyone who's interested in politics feels a sort of yearning of thinking, gee, it would be fun to do that. Also, I was working for Carter when I was in my mid-20s, and I didn't there's a lot more I know now that I didn't know then, so there's that part of me, too, yearns for it. On the other hand, One of the cruelest discoveries of my time of working for Carter is that unless you are really, really important in a government, unless you're one of the handful of people who really advises the president or really runs a big department, you have less influence over things from the inside than you often do from the outside. That what I could do writing speeches for President Carter was largely determined by what people wrote in newspaper columns, what they said on radio shows, what was on the TV. And so that is some consolation to me.
So how do you think Washington, D.C. is going to change now?
The real estate market will be the first barometer of change. And already, two realtors I've known called me in the last day just wanting to make sure if I had any Democratic friends coming to town would put them in touch, because this is the long-awaited, the long-hoped-for revival in the real estate market. I think very much like Hollywood, I think the personality of Washington is very much like a dog as opposed to a cat, in that it goes instantly to its master and has kind of no restraint or shame. And so whoever seems to be like the master at this moment, everybody will come slavering to it. And that is interesting to observe.
Does this feel like a new era is about to start?
Yes, it does. Because, the people are different. It's a different kind of people who are coming in here, and the ideas are different too. Now, both these sound like kind of boilerplate things to say. What I mean is that one has been accustomed for a long time now to see a certain kind of Republican that was well captured in a recent Saturday Night Live skit. They said, well, it was a parody of a Republican ad where they had an Asian woman saying, I'm a Republican, and a black man saying, I'm a Republican, and a Hispanic woman saying, I'm a Republican. Then this chorus of faces saying, we're all Republicans. And you had 500 white male lawyers behind them. And that's been kind of the tone, which I think will change. And the basic ideas of what makes America strong, I think, are changing too. So, yeah, it feels like something is underfoot or underway.
Well, James Fallows, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
James Fallows is Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.